for your life, please.
Well, Your Honor, I'm embarrassed to admit that I had an unfortunate cooking accident with a pot of hot oil, with which I was hoping to make French fries that set on fire, spilled on myself.
It's almost safer to ride your motorcycle.
Yes, sir. I wish I could say it. May it please the Court, this case concerns substantive and procedural questions involving resolving whether, in a particular case, a liability insurer is obligated to pay for insured liability to another. Specifically, the case concerns the relationship between, one, a judgment declaring the insured's liability in a proceeding involving only the insured and the injured party, and, two, a second proceeding in which one or both of those parties, and in our case, it reaches this Court, is the injured party, brings a second suit seeking to enforce the liability payment aspect of the insurer's contract. So the broad question is, how does the existence and circumstances of the first proceeding affect the issues in the second proceeding, particularly when, as here, the insurer mistakenly refused to defend the first case, and when, as here, the declaration of the insurer's liability in the first case is by agreement. The narrow question is whether the insurer's mistaken refusal to defend relieves the complainant of a burden to establish in his proceeding against the insurer that the injury resulting in the insurer's liability was an injury that comes within the general risks covered by the policy. In other words, in circumstances like this, is the insurer, in the second suit, entitled to contest or dispute the existence of coverage facts, assuming, as is the case here, there's conflicting evidence about whether the event giving rise to the insurer's liability was within the broad general coverage of the policy. Here, in this case, the coverage dispute concerns the time at which the injury occurred in relation to the period for which the policy was in effect. And there was conflicting evidence about that. The trial court said, yes, the insurer is entitled to contest the question of coverage in the second suit, and that, in fact, the insurer's liability depends on factual determinations of coverage facts in the second suit. And because there was no finding that the event giving rise to the insurer's liability occurred at a time when the policy was in effect, and the evidence conflicted on that, and there was an objection to the omission of such an issue, the trial court rendered judgment that plaintiffs take nothing. The Court of Appeals held in a somewhat of a confusing opinion, said, yes, the insurer is entitled in the second suit to contest coverage facts, but for two reasons that I'm going to be discussing, the Court of Appeals said, in this case, the insurer is liable even though there were no findings of facts bringing the event giving rise to the insurer's liability within the time period of the policy. Employers have issued a policy to Coating Specialists, Inc., a roofing company, covering the period of time August 1, 1980 to August 1, 1981. The Blocks sued Coating Specialists, contending that a roof put in place on their house by Coating Specialists leaked in August 1979, a year before the policy came into effect, and that it continued to leak after six or seven repair efforts in September and October of 1979 by Coating Specialists, and, here's a critical word, thereafter. I need to defer here for just a minute to distinguish the duty to defend and a liability policy and a duty to pay, because the two don't necessarily align. In Texas, we follow a liberal pleading rule when it comes to determining whether the defendant has a duty to defend. That whether the insurer has a duty to pay, of course, depends on some factual determination somewhere that the event giving rise to the insurer's liability was indeed a risk covered by the policy. To use an extreme illustration of the difference, suppose a plaintiff sues an insurer and contends that he caused injury as a result of negligence, but the evidence, there's no doubt, the evidence is conclusive that it was an assault and battery. The defendant has a duty to defend because going by the petition, cause of action is based in negligence, and that's covered. But if, when it comes to the factual resolution of what event actually gave rise to the insurer's liability, if it was an intentional tort, that's usually not covered. And so the duty to pay may not be there. But in any event, because of this word thereafter in the plaintiff's petition against the coding specialist and interpreting a pleading for purposes of duty to defend, our law is that if it's can be interpreted in any way to state facts from which even further facts could be inferred that the liability event occurred within coverage, then there's a duty to defend. So the trial court ruled, I found this court goes up, that this thereafter could, you know, be interpreted as being a pleading about injury in 1981, 82, 83, 84. So employers had a duty to defend. They mistakenly did not fulfill that duty. Our case is going to be an analysis of what the consequence flows from that. So when there was a refusal to defend, coding specialists and the blocks made an agreement that led to an agreed judgment in their case, setting damages, reciting coding specialist's liability, and reciting that this liability was based on an injury. This was leaking damage to the structure of the house. Resulted from a storm on August 6, 1980, a date within the coverage of the employer's policy, even though they had pleaded that this leaking began and injury began a year earlier. That's what was recited in the agreed judgment. And the evidence in this case, I think, just to get this out of the way, is not conclusive about when the injury occurred either way. The fact that Block's experts say, all I can do is make an educated conjecture just from looking at this old wood, and my opinion is that it was after August 6th. But he had to admit that, you know, certainly could have been damage caused a year earlier, as the Block's alleged in their petition. So after the agreed judgment, and also there was a covenant not to execute against the Blocks, against coding specialists as a result of this agreement, they both sued employers in the second case. It was tried first without a jury, and it resulted in a judgment that coding specialists recover its attorney fees from employers. And that's a right result. Both have been paid, and that's out of the case because an injury from an employer's failure to defend when it should have was the coding specialist's cost of defense. The Blocks sought recovery from employers of the amount of the agreed judgment. The trial court denied that recovery, concluding that in order to succeed in its second suit, the Blocks had to establish an element of reasonableness. That is, that the agreement that they made with coding specialists, or coding specialists really agreed with the Blocks to pay this money, was reasonable in amount, reasonable based on the prospects of liability, and made in good faith. And I want to divert just a second to discuss this element, because it's different from coverage, and it's really not winning. It's only tangentially before the court in this case. It arises out of general indemnity law. And the law is that when an indemnity, a claim is made against an indemnity, and the indemnity disposes of that claim by agreement, and then looks to the indemnitor for recoupment, which he's entitled to do under the law of indemnity, the law protects that indemnitor to the extent of making sure that he's not going to be liable simply for a gratuitous or a voluntarily assumed liability. So that indemnity, in bringing his claim to the indemnitor, the law says, square building and the official purchase agreement is one. The indemnity needs to establish that his settlement for which he seeks repayment was reasonable and done in good faith. Well, that aspect is carryover into this context of an insured making an agreement, disposing of the claim against him and then with him who's insured. But that was the issue on which the first trial, non-jury trial, turned. The judge concluded there had been no evidence of reasonableness for which he could not make a finding of reasonableness, and because of the absence of that element, rendered judgment in favor of employer. But the blocks had not, even the coding specialists got their attorney. Then the judge granted a new trial, and we had the second proceeding, which was a jury trial. There, the jury was submitted the question of reasonableness, and they found reasonableness. But no question was submitted inquiring whether the event giving rise to the claiming of the coding specialists and the judgment was an event that would be within the coverage of the policy. And the problem, as I mentioned, is this time of injury and period of the policy dispute. So for that reason, because the court concluded at the end of that jury trial, the employers objected to the omission of an issue inquiring whether the injury leading to the judgment did in fact occur within the policy period. None was submitted. So at the end of the trial, employers moved for judgment on the theory that there was, again, an essential element of the plaintiff's theory not submitted, the omission objected to. So the trial court agreed and again rendered judgment that the blocks had nothing against employers. And again, offered a new trial, realizing that this was a complicated area and wanting to be fair to the judge. But to the attorneys, he said he would grant a motion for a new trial. A motion, in fact, was filed but never presented and overruled, became overruled by operation of law. So the blocks then appealed to the Court of Appeals, who reversed and rendered judgment that the blocks recover the amount of the agreed judgment, holding that in this case it wasn't necessary to establish coverage fact in the second suit against the employers for two reasons. Number one, it wasn't in the case because employers didn't affirmatively plead it. And the Court of Appeals majority said it's covered by Rule 94, and that in order for it to be an issue in the case, the defendant had to affirmatively plead no coverage. The second reason was for holding in this case that the employers was liable despite the absence of the finding on coverage facts, is because the court held that the employer was conclusively bound, I'm going to talk about this in detail, by the recitation in the first judgment that the event giving rise to the insurance liability occurred on August 6, 1980, 5 days into the employer's policy with coding specialists. The Court of Appeals was wrong in both counts. So judgment should be reversed and the trial court's judgment should be affirmed. First, with regard to the pleading holding, this is one part of the case in which the law is not confusing at all. In our brief, we discussed three or four decisions of this court in which the distinction between an insurer's rebuttal claim of no coverage is totally different from an insurer's confession and avoidance reliance on the exclusion. And this court has just said over and over again, in terms could not be clearer, Rule 94 applies when you're relying on an exclusion, but it doesn't come close to the question when it's simply an insurer saying, wait a minute, you're suing me on a contract, and in order for you to get to first base on the contract, you must show that it applies to your case. And that is a claimant's burden, and these decisions are clear that it's in the case through a defendant's general denial. Why? Because it's not a confession in avoidance. It's not like an exclusion which carves out something that otherwise would be generally within the risk undertaken. Instead, it rebuts the fact that the claim to it ever was in the general risk cover. So I think it's just abundantly clear that the Court of Appeals was wrong on that, part. Next, the effect of the recitation of the coverage acts in the agreed judgment. Various courts of appeals in Texas, with some help from the Fifth Circuit, have made this area one rife with confusion, in my opinion. Ranger versus Rogers is the NRA case that is cited most frequently for the proposition, and this Court of Appeals followed it, that the agreed fact stated in the judgment, the consent judgment between coding specialists and the blocks, is conclusive on employers, even though employers was not a party, binding, and that to hold otherwise would be an impermissible collateral attack on that judgment. Ranger, in this case, and others, reaching that result in a kind of a res judicata idea, I think are quite wrong, as I'll explain. But they also confuse that kind of holding, or that kind of reason for their result, with waiver, which is another possibility for consequences that need to be resolved when an insurer doesn't provide a defense when it's supposed to. But I want to take just a minute to explain why our position is that res judicata and its cousins, collateral estoppel, and the prohibition against collateral attacks do not support collateral defenses. First of all, it's obvious lawyers was not party to that judgment. In terms of collateral estoppel, the fact alleged to estop the employer or the insurer in the second suit was not a fact essential to the judgment in the first case, because the coding specialist's liability to the blocks didn't depend on whether it occurred on August the 6th, 1980, or August the 6th, 1979. That was a gratuitous recitation of the fact that it wasn't essential to the judgment between on the claim between those parties. So it seems logical to me that under Bonnywell and other decisions of this court, that that is not a fact that we need to consider collateral responsible in the second case, because it wasn't essential to the first judgment. Most of these decisions, without really explaining why, seem to conclude that there's some kind of privity between the insurer and the insured, and the language in Ranger versus Rogers, which is cited very frequently, is that having had the opportunity to defend, the insurer is, quote, no stranger to that judgment, and therefore it's just simply binding them. Well, to show you how the courts of appeal get the decisions in this area are confusing, in Ranger versus Rogers, the court applied that res judicata kind of holding to the reasonableness element, but it didn't apply to the coverage facts. They went on and decided whether there was coverage, but said the first agreed judgment stops the defendant from contesting this indemnity rule about reasonableness of the settlement. Another recent case, Burke Ford Enterprises, the Court of Appeals case in 86, no writ, I believe, court undertook a thorough discussion of all of this, sought to arrive at the right result, and relying on a Fifth Circuit case, held that, well, it's not res judicata on reasonableness, but it is res judicata on coverage facts that are decided in the first degree case. We submit that both of them are wrong, because it's simply not a res judicata question, and I think a good way to express that is Professor Hodges' writings about collateral estoppel in Texas Law Review the two articles in Volume 41. He takes great care to distinguish things that aren't really attacks on judges. They kind of look like they are, but in order for there to be an attack on a judgment so that it would be prescribed by the rule not allowing a collateral attack on a judgment, you have to really be attacking the judgment. You have to want that judgment to have no effect. And that's not the situation here. This insurer is not wanting another chance to adjudicate the insurer's liability. That's done. That's in that judgment. And I would agree that as between those two parties, that can't be redone by somebody else. Similarly, the amount of the judgment, I think, has some, is something that can't be redone in a second. This is subject to this indemnity rule at reasonableness because there's no need to. It's the consequence of the first judgment. And what is its consequence on the issues of the second case? It's the real question, not whether that first judgment needs to be disregarded or as a successful collateral attack. We're not, that judgment doesn't stand in the way of the relief that we seek. They're just simply two different questions. There's not res judicata principle involved at all for the reasons that I've said. And I'm going to come back to waiver because I think that's a more appropriate theory with which to analyze the effect of the insurer not fulfilling this contractual duty to defend when it was supposed to. And I should say, courts also confuse the forfeiture conditions of the policy. Conditions preceded, such as notice, the no action clause, those things that don't really go to the general risk covered, but are in there for more administrative purposes. It's different from the general question of risk in this insuring agreement that the part that the insurer undertook. This court decided a case 2 weeks ago, which Texas Farmers versus McGuire, which I think answers the question in this case, because since it can't be res judicata, it can't be any of those kinds of things because the insurer simply wasn't a party. The issue there wasn't critical to the decision, and it's not a collateral attack on that judgment. Waiver is the only thing that's left. And waiver really is the only concept that justifies the decisions in which courts of appeals have held, well, insurer, you didn't defend, you should have, and you're going to suffer for it. Here's how. In accordance with this court's holding of McGuire, and it's been the law in this state for a long time, from Minnesota Mutual versus Washington, it's in our brief, an insurer's breach of its contract can result in a waiver of rights to rely on forfeiture provisions. In the case of Hilly and in the McGuire and in decisions cited in the McGuire opinion. But waiver cannot operate to make a new contract, which is what the effect of these holdings is. These holdings, by courts of appeals, saying, insurer, I'm sorry, you refuse to defend, you have lost your right to insist on a determination of whether there was coverage. Well, that means nothing other than the fact that by your conduct, you have created a larger, more expansive risk than the one that you agreed to when you wrote the policy. And Texas law does not recognize creation of a new contract in this context, which said very clearly in the bar, by waiver. So putting that together, the result can only be that in order for the insurer to be liable for the event giving rise to the insurer's liability and the agreed judgment, there must be some determination in a proceeding to which the insurer is a party establishing those initial facts of being that the event everybody's talking about was when it was covered by the policy. And here, that has never been done. And so, for those reasons, the Court of Appeals withdrawing the trial court statement should be confirmed.
We'll hear from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Tim Burke, to present argument for respondent.
My name is Jim Perkins, and I represent George and Marjorie Block, and also the attorney of Southern Specialist Rights and Claims. Before I get into the gross inaccuracies that Eric used across argument, I'd like to first point out that he tried to couch the case as one of mistaken belief on the part of the employer's casualty, not to defend its insured, but the trial court held that there was a wrongful refusal to defend in this case, not a mistaken belief, a wrongful refusal to defend. And that issue has never, ever been contested by employer's casualty to this day.
What's the wording of the issue? If you refuse to do it by mistake, it's wrongful. Isn't that the same thing?
There was a judicial finding by the court in the record saying it was wrongful.
What's the difference in that and mistake?
Well, I think basically what it is there was an intent on the part of the employer's casualty to let its insured go.
I just wanted to establish.
That's terrible. I mean, it wasn't a mistake per se, but oops, we goofed or something like that.
Well, they deliberately refused to do it, but it was because of their mistaken belief that it wasn't covered. Is that right or wrong?
Excuse me, Daniel, it wasn't covered.
They deliberately refused to do it, but it was because of their mistaken belief that it wasn't covered. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. They had every opportunity to ascertain whether there was coverage or not, either by defending under reservation of rights or finding special exceptions or a number of different remedies that were available to them, but they'll not at all.
Go ahead.
And also, I'd like to correct an error in Mr. Cross' brief where he says that the wording in the plaintiff's pleading said that there continued to be root licking. That's not what the pleading said. It said thereafter the root once again began to root. It never said it continued to root. And that's on page 19, I believe, and that is an error. The event that gave rise to this destruction to the Block's home was Hurricane Allen. It wasn't a little storm of Lou Norda that blew in one day. It was Hurricane Allen that deluged 16 inches of rain on San Antonio and caused the damage. A determination was made at the time the underlying case, Block versus Covenant Specialist, was called a trial, that the insurance Covenant Specialist had been done wrong. And everybody agreed to that. There had been written notice to employer's casualty to please come forward and defend the case, and they said it has to be refused. And at the time this case was called a trial, an agreement was entered into, which was Mr. Cross's outline, and the agreed judgment was signed and entered by the court. And that agreed judgment set out a number of different facts. And one of those facts was that the occurrence giving rise to the damages occurred on August 5th, 1980. It didn't say there was coverage on August 6, 1980. It said the occurrence happened on that day. And that also became final, and employer's casualty didn't do anything to directly attack that judgment. And they never had. Probably writ of error, bill of review, or anything like that, alleging fraud or any such thing. No finding like that has ever been found in this case. So we proceeded on to a jury trial after a confusing non-jury trial in front of Judge Beery, where he said, basically, the issue that we're going to be trying here is the reasonableness of the damages contained in that agreed judgment, and nothing more. He was, at that time, enunciated on the record that he was relying on the Ranger versus Rogers case, so that he wouldn't even, at the first trial, was never admitted any evidence as a reason for damages, and just said, employers, you wrongfully refused to defend, and you're going to have to pay these damages. Well, a motion for new trial was filed, and the judge went 180 degrees and said, I'm not going to rely on Ranger versus Rogers, I'm going to rely on Parker Products now, and you've got to prove the reasonableness of your damages. The issue of coverage was never, ever raised by anybody during this whole affair. We pled and I plead that the coverage, that was August 6th, and we went to trial on that. The judgment was entered into the record showing the date of the occurrence as of August 6th. There was just a wave after wave of testimony that Hurricane Allen was what caused this. It wasn't just Mr. Worrell, as Mr. Cross has mischaracterized the testimony. It was Mr. Block who was there. John Bevel, the attorney for the insured, to testify to that. It was a judgment that was introduced into evidence. All those pieces of evidence were introduced to show that this occurrence happened on August 6, 1980, within the policy period. Never, never, ever, any whimper out of them about collusion or fraud in fixing that date in the policy. And we went to the jury trial on the same issue. And there was a state of confusion again with the trial court about how to submit the issue. And basically what I said, judges, you know, with the last experience I had, I don't know how you want these issues submitted. Why don't you draw them up and we'll submit them? And he did. And he fixed the date, the judge fixed the date, is August 6, 1980, and the special issues that the jury answered. And the jury found that the damages were reasonable and that the attorney's fees were reasonable. Lawyers never, until after they filed a motion for judgment in NOV, brought up this affirmative defense that there was no coverage. And it took me aback because the overwhelming evidence had meant that the date the occurrence happened was August 6th. And now they come in and say, we, in our pleadings, said that under this policy, exclusion K applies, and therefore there's no coverage. But now they're coming back again and saying, we may have pled exclusion K to get us out from under coverage, but there was no coverage, so that pleading was ridiculous and absurd. It defies logic how someone could say exclusion K applied and then come back and say that there's no coverage. Our evidence at trial was more than enough to wipe out exclusion K, but that was never seriously an issue. But the two points of error that are before you today are numbers 1 and 5. And issue number 1 is whether employers had a duty to affirmatively plead that there was no coverage. The cases are confusing on that point. There are some cases that hold that you have a duty, and there are some that say that you don't. And I think this court should clarify this once and for all. What employers are saying is that there's a hole big enough to drive a truck through in Rule 94, and that even though it says you have to plead everything by way of avoidance or affirmative defense, there's a big exception there that this court didn't want you to create. It says, but not insurance coverage. But that's just not what they did in the suit, and it was brought up later as a way to avoid the consequences of their wrongful refusal to defend. And the point that the respondents make here is that what use whatsoever is Rule 94 if it's going to be riddled with exceptions? The answer is it's of no use. You might as well do away with the rule.
Help me with something, and this is just conceptual. You file a lawsuit to recover under an insurance policy under which you say there's coverage. Is it your burden as plaintiff to establish that there was coverage?
I don't think so. Once the finding of wrongful refusal to defend has been made, that
you got to show there's coverage for it to be even relevant, don't you?
Well, Your Honor, my belief may be a little farther ahead than what the case law shows. The cases hold Ranger versus Rogers, Parker Products, and the Ron case. Judge Kilgarvin was the trial judge and held that, yes, you do have to prove there's coverage. The Court of Appeals agreed with us that we had proved coverage, and our motion for directed verdict should have been proved. I mean, should have been upheld by the court. There was one dissent by Justice Sutton in the court below. But the state of the law is, yes, you do have to prove coverage. My position would be that if an insurance company intentionally abandons its insured, it's at its peril. That's the direct quote out of Andrew D. Rogers. It's at its peril when something else, three judgments taken against it. Because to hold otherwise, it's going to let insurance companies or others just say, we're not going to defend you, and it's your problem.
Is it an element of avoidance, of confession and avoidance, for an insurance company to have to establish that the loss didn't occur within the covered period?
I would think absolutely, Your Honor, and I would think that I, the plaintiff's lawyer in this case, would be entitled to pleading that would alert me after I had pled all these elements and proved all these elements that they were going to say, no, there's no coverage because it was outside. That is avoidance. It's an affirmative defense. Absolutely.
Well, avoidance, doesn't that say that there's coverage, but there's some exception to the coverage that would apply?
That's what the rule literally read says. But
the basic cause of action would be yours to establish that the loss you sustained is covered by that insurance policy.
That's what the law of this state is. And we did that. Because the jury answered the issues. Said that this happened on August 6th. The policy was introduced into evidence at the trial. The agreed judgment was introduced into evidence, said August 6th. I don't know what else I could do to prove it. I had an abundance of testimony to prove those facts.
Can you develop a legal theory for us to write the case on that would allow us to say that the agreed judgment is not going to bind this insurance company because they were not a party to it, but that their action thereafter in the court trial and the jury trial would be enough to bind them? Can you develop any theory there that...
Well, I think that my belief is that that has already been developed by the Ranger, Ron, and the Parker Products case, which says that an insurer is not a stranger to the consent judgment that wrongfully refuses to defend, and it's at its peril for what happened.
I'm not sure that case holds that,
Mr. Kinson.
The writer, is that what you're claiming, that it holds?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think it goes that far. Suppose you had a case where the insurance company clearly did not have coverage. Just assume that for a moment. If you follow your logic, if one could simply just enter into any kind of agreement it wanted to and recite a false, and I'm saying that applies here, but could do that, and then just rewrite the contract, just rewrite coverage when clearly there wasn't any.
Well, that is certainly something that could happen, that's true, but it didn't in this case. And the remedy available to employers was to defend it under a reservation of rights. Motion for summary judgment, any number of things. But what they did was not what they were supposed to do or had a duty to do to their insurer. What they did was read the pleading and said, we don't see a date within the coverage and we're not going to defend you. So there are other remedies available to the insurance company to prevent that. Obviously, if it's collusion and fraud, that can be pled by the insurance company on the writ of their bill of review. But they didn't do that either.
I guess I'm just searching for a rule of law that would be the best rule of law to reach that where you're going. Assuming that one was not persuaded by your first argument that just because there's an agreed judgment that ends the inquiry, is there some other legal analysis that would support you?
I think what I just stated is perfect. Remedy available to those insurance companies that wrongfully refuse to defend and are confronted with these three judgments. And the correct analysis has to be that an insurance company has noticed that a suit is filed and refuses to defend it wrongfully. They have many options available to them at that point. If they just completely turn their backs on their insurers after their insurers pay the premiums, and tried to get their help in defending the case, I think that the proper rule of law is that they would be at their peril, absent a direct attack on that judgment and the court that rendered it.
Counsel, I had, here's where I'm having problems, and you can help me. If someone has a claim against another person, and there's some question about whether or not it's within the policy period, so they file a friendly lawsuit, not necessarily friendly, but one which they can agree to, and they enter a judgment reciting facts that are not correct facts, but facts which would bring the occurrence within the policy coverage period, or policy coverage in any way. And then they go and they file a lawsuit against the insurance company saying, you didn't defend us because here's a judgment that says that this loss occurred within under the terms of the policy. Now, you can't go behind this judgment because it's already entered. You can't question the fact that as to when the loss occurred or if the loss were covered. It's already been determined judicially. So you owe us the money. What's the insurance company to do? What remedies do they have? Purely fabricated, you understand?
Right. The point that I'm trying to make is that...
I'll answer my question, then make your point.
What remedy does the insurance company have? On a direct attack, many remedies. On a collateral attack, I don't think they should have any.
What kind of direct attack do they have to a proceeding to which they're not a party? After this court's held many times that you can't do that.
Well, after the judgment's been entered, Your Honor, and they have noticed that the judgment's been entered, I think that equitable bills of review, if there's collusion and fraud are available to them,
they're not a party. How can they seek an equitable bill of review to a proceeding to which they're not a party?
Well, really,
how can they appeal from a decision to which they're not a party?
But the Ranger cases hold that they are a party, that they are in privity with their insurer.
That doesn't mean they're a party to the lawsuit that can appeal it. Does it? Ranger doesn't hold that.
No, Ranger does not hold that. But my feeling would be that if the insurance company wrongfully refuses to defend and they are a party, they are in privy with their insurer.
So what you're saying is that two parties can get together and concoct a claim that's outside the terms of the policy, enter a judgment, and then sue on that insurance policy, and the insurance company can't question the recitations of facts in that colluded lawsuit concluded.
It's in the nature of sanctions. If you don't comply with certain rules of discovery, your pleadings can be stricken, and you're at your peril in that event too. But I think the point that I'm maybe not making very well here is that the insurance companies had noticed they had remedies available. They could have come in and defended, but they didn't. And to answer your question, if there's a concocted set of circumstances where that would occur, and the insurance company had noticed, then I would say that they're at their peril.
So do you think notice, actual or otherwise notice, is the answer to the hypothetical situation?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm not saying that two parties go in without notifying the insurance company and cost the judgment, and then later on confront the insurance company with the judgment to pay them. In this case, and I think to narrow the application down, if there is a wrongful refusal to defend found by the court, then they are at their peril after they have noticed and opportunity to do so.
Well, but assume the hypothetical situation Judge Spears was speaking to. What is the answer there? Or two people do get together and collude against an insurance company, don't give them any notice, they have no way of knowing about it, then what is their defense when they come and try and execute on that or collect under that fraudulent judgment that a brother-in-law deal they got together and got rid of?
The remedy, I mean, present law, I don't know, because I haven't read any cases that have ever held that set of circumstances. That's a tough call to make, and I really can't answer it because I didn't have the situation to find the case on the point.
But what you're saying is that's not the facts in this case.
Absolutely not. And it wasn't the facts in Ranger and Lahan and all the other cases that have been decided when there is a finding by the court of wrongful refusal to defend. I don't know of any case law that would answer that point specifically. In conclusion,
regarding my closing comments, that was point number five, and that was that the agent through judgment was binding as to the insurance company. So the final judgment deciding that August 6th, 1980 was the date that the damage occurred last summer. There was never any finding that coverage existed because of that, or the exclusion clause, or anything else. All of us said it would happen on that date. They could still have avoided coverage if there was a valid reason under all the case law not to defend. But in this case, August 6th happened to be the date of the damage, and that happened to be within the policy period, and that was proven conclusively at trial. And they never, ever won. Objected to that date as being the day of the accident. Their whole argument during this whole time had been if the damages that we said occurred, the $30,000 group damages were excessive and unreasonable. And that this case, drawn from that issue, we now have a related issue of our lay down on the direct evidence of the judgment. I often say that.
You talk about coverage is not the issue of your displacement?
Yes, sir. It is not. I am not.
If that's true, then it's escaped me. I assume.
Well, Your Honor, the coverage was an issue, and a federal issue under exclusion tax. Now, how can you say that an exclusion clause
to file a motion for summary judgment? That was the case.
But I mean, let's just suppose they just filed a general denial and they didn't say anything about cash. Would it have been your burden to approve coverage in that situation?
Yes, it would have been my burden if they had raised the issue, but they did not. They did not raise the issue in this case. There is no pleading in the form of an affirmative defense from this insurance company other than exclusion pay applied.
He says he doesn't have to plead an exclusion. You have to prove coverage. That's your burden, not his, to prove non-coverage.
Well, I agree with that, and I did. And that's what the Court of Appeals held.
In a proceeding to which they were not a party.
No, Your Honor, that's not true.
You went beyond that.
I went beyond that. We introduced the judgment. They could have done anything they wanted to avoid the binding effect of that judgment, like showing that the loss occurred outside that date. But they didn't. They didn't have one expert witness, one rebuttal witness, nobody. And so we carried our burden as a matter of law. But the issue that's before the court now is whether Rule 94 mandates that the issue of coverage should be pled as an affirmative defense. And I believe that it should. Otherwise, the rule is going to be ruled with exception.
In order to be brief, I'm just going to have to categorically deny most of what you said about the response, especially with regard to the facts. First, the testimony concerning the decision not to defend came from the adjuster who said, we look at this petition over and over. All we saw was 1979, the year before the policy ever came into effect. As it turns out, they made a mistake in not knowing what the significance of the word thereafter was. But there was certainly no evidence of any kind of any malintent on the part of the insurer. In fact, the adjuster said, I kept calling the insurer's lawyers and saying, where is there some indication that this occurred within the policy period? And this attorney was quite abrupt with the insurer and said, well, I've got some documents, but wouldn't describe them. And said, well, the investor said, where are they? Can I have a copy of them? And he said, no, they're here in my office somewhere. Quote, get off your ass, come out here and look for them.
Mr. Grubbs, excuse me. And talk about the issue that Mr. Perkins drew as to your participation in these later cases where you did not mention coverage, didn't plead anything except the K.
Okay. Let me first get exclusion K out of the way. Exclusion K is an exclusion in the policy that carves out of coverage damage to property under the control of the insured. And it's a standard provision. In this case, it was the cost of repairing the roof itself. Exclusion K covered that because that was what was being worked on. That's what the insured, and they didn't dispute that. And in fact, in their agreed judgment, they separated that out. And they didn't, and their claim against employers, they didn't even seek that because they understood, sure, that's an exclusion. And that's taking care of it really plays no role in the case. It's totally different from the question of whether the injuries even occurred within the policy period. And we submit that that was a burden any claimant on a contract has to prove. And pleading and proof evidence burden to establish, yes, the contract I'm seeking to enforce is enforceable against you. That's a plaintiff's element.
It's hard to know. If you look at footnote 7 on page 14 of the Court of Appeals opinion, this is kind of where I can't quite tell what they're holding. They say, we hold that employer's casualty failed to properly raise a coverage question other than exclusion K, which it did not attempt to prove. And thus, in this case, the insurer is precluded from contesting coverage liability concerning the covered event.
Your Honor, I think that's just more talk about Rule 94 and this Court of Appeals' erroneous conclusion that Rule 94 applies and that a rebuttal of, I'm sorry, claimant, you haven't pleaded that this contract is even applicable to your injury, and that's a rebuttal, and this Court of Appeals just lumped it in the category with exclusions and concessions and avoidance, and said it's not in the case, it's the defendant affirmatively pleads no coverage, and that's just wrong, and the opinions in our brief of this court answer that precise question, in accordance with the way Justice Butts did in the dissent. Now, as to being raised at some late hour from the very first witness that got on the stand offered by the Blocks, that is, the roof repairer, coating specialist man, their expert, Mr. Worrell, and the Blocks themselves, from the very beginning of cross-examination, the defendant honed in on the inquiry of, well, do we know that this occurred after August the 1st? Because...
Well, the counsel, he's not talking about your cross-examination with his witnesses. He's talking about your plea. When, for the first time, did you raise the question in your pleadings about no coverage? Was it on the motion for judgment, not summoning?
Well, I would say that's the first time the defect in the plaintiff's case was raised, but we raised that by filing a general denial, Your Honor, because that we are denying the facts. And all we need to do is generally deny, and that rebuts facts on which the other side has the burden of proof.
Did your pleading at the same time you filed your general denial include your exclusion K?
Yes,
offense.
Yes. Because that would require, if I remember.
But did not require. But you did not include in that same pleading where you raised the exclusion K defense the non-coverage question.
That's covered by your general denial.
Yes, sir. What Rule 94 requires affirmative pleading, Your Honor, of an exclusion. It specifically requires it, and that's why we did it. But a rebuttal of overall general coverage, not a carving out like an exclusion, is not an affirmative defense. It's a rebuttal. And as a general rule, evidence and theories rebutting an opposing party's ground of recovery or defense comes in under a general plea because it's simply denying facts on which the other side has the burden of pleading to establish. So Rule 94 simply, in the decisions of this court, as I've said too many times now, confront that distinction head on. Rule 94 exclusion, yes. A rebuttal of coverage at the outset, generally not. So if the question comes down to our pleading, then I am as confident as I've ever been on any position that it's been, that the Court of Appeals was just wrong on that score. I understood the argument to be that we've never said a whispering word about no coverage until after the judgment, and that's what I was responding to. I'm sorry to visit that. there's no conclusive proof that it occurred after August 1st, because there's evidence that it began a year before August 1998, and the expert asked to say, well, did this all occur? Well, I sure think so, but I can't say, give you more than an educated conjecture. There's no way to know for sure. So it wasn't conclusively proven, and it was simply a matter of something that the jury should have been asked to decide. The fact that the jury wasn't asked, the fact that the defendant objected, means that the judgment should have been for the defendant.
So it is the date of the hurricane conclusively established in this record?
There's a little bit of disagreement about, I'm remembering some dialogues with one of the lawyers, I think, questioned whether it occurred on August 6th. Your Honor, I don't know. It seems like most of the treatment of it is sort of an assumption that it was on August 6th.
Conclusively established it was after August 1st.
Yes, sir, I would say that. on their conclusive claim, I might add that the Court of Appeals did not say that the Blocks were entitled to the direct verdict because they had conclusively proven that the event occurred within the period of coverage. That holding about being entitled to the direct verdict was expressly based on race and color, and their conclusion that the insurer had no standing at all to question the agreed statement in the first proceeding. I should also, I want to also say that on this question of race here, that some ill will or some bad purpose in denying, which I think, the defense, which I think is nothing in the evidence that would even lead to that position. I want to say we're not contending that a waiver of forfeiture provision is the only consequence that there ever could be from an insurer's refusal to defend. I think in the right circumstances, if other damage were caused by a negligent refusal to defend, and that was the theory of the case, or a bad faith refusal to defend, it might be as suggested by other decisions of this court this year, there certainly might be an action for something like that. That's not in this case at all. This is simply the consequence of a good faith, erroneous interpretation of the contractual duty. And its consequence, as decided by this court in McGuire, is the only forfeiture, and it cannot operate, that this Court of Appeals has to operate, to expand coverage by depriving the insurer of a right to insist on true coverage facts to be established against it. I want to mention, in closing, one other case, a recent NRA case, 1987, Bridge versus Cambridge, in which the court treats this problem in a different kind of context. That was more of a collusive, more evidence of a collusive agreement, and we have never continued that in this case. I don't think it makes any difference. But in explaining why there is no privity between the insurer and the insured for purposes of some res judicata ramification in the first proceeding, that Court of Appeals, also the San Antonio Court, refers to the restatement of judgments indemnity provisions in their special kind of res judicata. The restatement says that when an indemnitor owes a duty to defend and is given the opportunity to defend and does not do so, then the judgment can be binding on the intended tort with a number of exceptions, most prominent of which is, except when there is a conflict of interest between the intended tort and the intended fee. And conflict of interest is defined as a situation in which one fact could be found one way and it would work to the advantage of the intended tort. Some of the facts in another way, what advantages we can do, there's a conflict. And that's exactly the situation we have when ask yourself whether there ought to be some kind of a prisoner relationship that binds the insurer who has a conflict of interest with the insurer with respect to coverage that is bound by the insurer's agreement with the injured person that what was the degree of facts that make this cover? That's all, Mr.
President. Thank you, counsel. That concludes the business of the court. Marshall, please adjourn the court.
All right. Oye, oye, oye. I'm just going to court, now stand adjourned, subject to call.